Today on The Frame Weekend, Ben Stiller ditches comedies to direct the real-life prison break story Escape at Donnemara.
This is about three people who did pretty bad things and really didn't get redeemed in any way and shouldn't necessarily be redeemed. And so, you know, what is it that's going to keep people watching? And to me, it was about the humanity and what we could see in ourselves in the story.
Also, Julio Torres finds strange humor in ordinary objects, like what does that curtain separating first class from coach think about its job? And Gina Davis says that no one is free from unconscious bias.
So we have to realize we have it. You cannot say, I'm hiring based purely on merit because I'm that woke, because you're not.
It's all on The Frame Weekend. We're in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. Stay with us. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame Weekend. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later on today, we meet the composer behind Stanley Kubrick's final film, the psychodrama Eyes Wide Shut. But let's start with actor and director Ben Stiller. He's between projects now, but his last gig, directing the Showtime limited series Escape at Donnemara, has earned him an Emmy nomination. Ben, this seems like a really basic question. Dannemora or Donnemora?
I say Dannemora.
Okay,
but I also say Aqua, and everybody in my family makes fun of me for saying Aqua instead of Aqua. So
Dannemora.
I think it's Dannemora.
Escape at Donnemora tells the riveting true story of two men who broke out of a maximum security prison. They were aided by a prison worker named Joyce Tilly Mitchell. She's played by Patricia Arquette. The prisoners are played by Benicio del Toro and Paul Dano. All three have Emmy nominations, as does the series itself. I want you to think back to when it actually happened.
LA here. We're cutting into regular programming because of last night's prison break in Dannemora. Governor Andrew Cuomo has arrived in the North Country and is at the prison right now. These two inmates have been identified as 48-year-old Richard Matt, 34-year-old David Sweat.
These are two dangerous individuals. First order of business is to find the two individuals and return them to prison.
Do you have a specific recollection of hearing about the escape, or did it come to you later?
I was actually in Italy filming Zoolander 2 when it happened.
It wasn't really on the headlines.
Yeah, I was focused on that, and it didn't make the Italian headlines. You know, it was when they sent me the script. Michael Tolkien and Brett Johnson sent me the script that they had written a few months after it happened. That's when I really first heard about it.
And did they send it to you thinking you would direct, produce, act? What was the initial conversation?
It was not to act. they were looking for a director, and they didn't have it set up at a network or anywhere. They just had the script, and they wanted to try to put it together.
I would say this story and Zoolander 2 exist in that they're both actors saying lines and then people sit and watch them.
That you watch on a screen.
Exactly. Yeah. And even if they don't have any kind of obvious connections, was there something that spoke to you about this story that maybe has appealed to you throughout your career?
Well, yeah. I mean, for me as a director, it's the type of thing that I've probably wanted to do for a long time. And it was just the timing of it and how it happened. I think also, you know, I didn't say yes to it at first because I didn't really know enough about what had happened. And at that point, there wasn't that much information about what had really happened. And I didn't want to make it up. As an audience, I know I'd want to watch it. But in terms of directing something like this, I knew that for me, the connection was what really happened. How does something like this happen in this day and age? And I wanted to just sort of cling on to the facts.
So in June of 2016, Catherine Leigh Scott, the Inspector General for the State of New York, releases this report, which I read through this morning, and it reads like a novel. It is like a Michael Connelly novel. some great crime writer, and it's got so many great little details in it. So when this comes out, does this change your thinking? Does it change the whole nature of the script?
Yeah, well, it actually was the reason that I came back and said I wanted to do it. And I immediately emailed with Brett and Michael because they saw it too. It was in the New York Times. It just came out. You could just click on the PDF. It was, you know, it just read so, it was just, you know, fascinating. And it was so detail oriented that I thought, okay, this is the source material. And if we want to start from scratch with all these real details, which are much more interesting than anyone could make up, then let's do it.
It's more interesting and more unbelievable than anything anybody could make up. There's stuff smuggled in frozen hunks of meat. There are these little things about what is permitted, how things happen. I mean, the chronology of every little thing that happened, I think if you wrote it in a screenplay, you'd get a studio executive who's like, there's no way.
Yeah, a lot of it just seemed kind of made up or almost like, oh, that would be in a movie or that would be too, you know, cheesy or corny to be in a movie. And that the fact that it was real was what was so fascinating to me. And then it made me want to learn more about the culture at the prison that allowed this kind of thing to happen.
So when you start thinking about the culture of the prison and about the people who are going to help tell this story, pretty quickly, Joyce Mitchell emerges as a key character in the Inspector General's report. So for people who haven't watched, who is Joyce Mitchell and why is she such an important path into telling this tale?
Well, she was really, I think, the most interesting part of the story on the face of it because she's the person who worked. She was a civilian worker at the prison who was a civilian supervisor in the tailor shop. So in this prison, Clinton Correctional, which is a New York State prison, you know, maximum security. There are murderers and rapists and felons who work in this tailor shop making clothes for a company that is a for-profit company called Corecraft. And it's 40 or so of these inmates in a room with one civilian supervisor and one corrections officer. And they're working at sewing machines and they have to make quotas and it's run like a business. And the civilian supervisor is in charge of making sure that all that happens. And she happens to be a woman in with these 40 men, and, you know, things happen in that environment. And she got involved with two of the inmates and helped them escape.
We're talking with Ben Stiller, director and executive producer of the Showtime series Escape at Donnemara. You are casting not only actors to play these characters, you're casting the location. And the prison is as much a character in the story as are the actors. How did you and your production designer approach the challenge of getting the location, because it wasn't easy? And what did that give you as a storyteller to actually be in that space and shooting where the escape actually happened?
We went up there very early on. And when you go there and you see this place, which dominates the landscape, this huge prison in this very, very small town, it's really the prison is bigger than the town. It's got this 30 or 40 foot wall that lines the main road. So you could just drive through the town and the prison's on the right side. You just could drive west right through. You'd be through in like, I don't know, 3 minutes, you know? But this prison is basically the economy of the entire area. I mean, the prison's been there for over 100 years. So it's generational. And that place is really, I think, sort of the core of why all this happened, because these people are isolated there. It's the wintertime. And they both need and resent this place. So we needed to film there. And it's very hard to recreate an environment like that.
When you think about the movies that you watched growing up, the prison escapes films, do you go back and watch them or do you try to kind of clean your memory from them so that you don't fall into the same kind of cliches or ways of telling that story?
I mean, I definitely was aware of not wanting to do. I mean, that's why I kept on coming back to the reality of what happened, because I felt like, you know, there have been so many great prison stories. How can we make up something or do something better than it's been done before? We could do something different if it's based on the reality of what actually happened. And for me, those movies, I never was a huge prison escape genre fan, but I love those movies from the era that a lot of those films were made in, the 70s. So stylistically, I watched a bunch of them just to kind of see, like even Escape from Alcatraz.
I'm going to put, with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that on very high on the list.
Yeah. No, it's great. And when you look at it, there's actually a lot of similarities in that story to what actually happened.
Dummy in the bed.
Yeah. Yep. And when you look at the dummy, how bad the dummy is. But these guys in reality at Clinton were, they did dummies in beds that were even worse, you know, but it worked.
The other thing that they did is they referenced to themselves the Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
When they're actually plotting and doing some logistical work, they're thinking about, well, we can't do this because it didn't work in the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, they got to down to the basically the outer wall of the prison after weeks and weeks of searching and going down every night, you know, between bed check and when they would wake up. And they got to the outer wall of the prison and they started sort of chipping away at it. And they joked with each other, him and Richard Matt, that this was like Shawshank Redemption. It's like, how long did it take in Shawshank Redemption? 20 years. It's going to take us 10. And we had that line in the show. And we shot it, and when I watched it, it was just too, it just seemed too self-referential or something. I thought people would, it took people out of it.
Even though it was
even though
said.
It actually was said. So that's like an example of using, it couldn't use something that was real because it seemed almost phony or something.
Ben, thanks for coming in.
All right. Thanks, John.
That was awesome.
Cool.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
I could talk about this a long time.
That was fun.
You can watch Escape at Donnemora if you have Showtime or the Showtime app. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Toni Morrison passed away on Monday. She was 88 years old. The Nobel Prize winner's novels and essays spanned four decades and included monumental works like The Bluest Eye and Beloved. Journalist Linnell George published an essay of appreciation in the LA Times following Morrison's death. Linnell, welcome back to The Frame.
Hi, John. Thank you.
So in your essay, you write that Morrison, quote, was both a mirror and a map, unquote. So I'm curious, how did Morrison's work reflect the Black American experience and also suggest what might be possible?
The thing that was really striking about her work for me as a young person growing up, as a child really, was my mother's reaction to it. So it reached back into a history that I wasn't aware about. So it was these very personal details about how people lived, how they dressed, what they ate, how they moved through the world, language. And that was the mirror. And it was these details that were very specific to African-American communities post-war. The map was her personal way moving through her professional world. There weren't women like her out there. She was a single mother raising two boys, and she had this job working as an editor, getting up at 4 a.m. and writing.
The one thing that I was always struck by Toni Morrison's writing is that not only was she an underrepresented voice as a novelist, but she was giving voice to underrepresented characters in her novels.
Absolutely. So you had women, mostly, as the protagonists. Strong women, struggling women, women who were, like, dealing with all kinds of trauma. They were, in so many different ways, challenged and sometimes broken by the challenge. But it's what happens when they put themselves back together again and what they become. And that was the redemption.
I want to play a clip of Morrison reading from her 1987 novel, Beloved.
The picture of the men coming to nurse her was as lifeless as the nerves in her back, where the skin buckled like a washboard. Nor was there the faintest scent of ink or the cherry gum and oak bark from which it was made. Nothing. Just the breeze cooling her face as she rushed toward water.
I mean, if she wasn't a novelist, she would be a poet, because her very specific choice of language and words and phrasing. How would you describe her writing style? And do you think she influenced another generation of writers?
Just hearing her voice just now, so moving. She so loved language, and she so loved finding the right word. It's lush, but it's also, it cuts. It's like rolling through a wash. You are in the water of her language. And yes, you can so see there's the inheritors of this language being able to tell their stories in a way that is elevated in the detail. And she actually demanded that of people. She said, tell your story in detail.
I'd like to ask you to read from your essay. I've highlighted it for you.
Okay. As a very young reader, flipping through a magazine, years away from knowing that I'd even entertain the idea of being a writer, I would catch a glimpse of her with her cloud of an afro working. Seated in academia, a circle of students before her, her face placid, eyes ablaze. She demanded respect. Other photographs capture her, bent over stacks of paper, passing pencil marks along sentences and manuscripts in a New York City publishing house, making a way. She cleared space for all of us to follow. It was intentional, every gesture. Her very being and presence was an affirmation and declaration. There is a place for you, but you will have to demand it.
Let's talk about you. Let's talk about what her words meant to you, not only as a young reader, but also as an aspiring writer.
Mm. I think as I started out, and I have to go back to my mother, there was something about Toni Morrison that really, really spoke to her. And we'd have to be reverent and quiet when she was reading her Toni Morrison. And I realized that I needed to pay attention to her. She required that we slow down and look and listen. And by doing that, we were paying respect to these people that readers, people in the world, just didn't see. She forced us to pay attention to them.
I think we all know Beloved as maybe her best-known work.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something from her later years that you would call attention to that people might want to check out?
I really loved Jazz, and I think Jazz got lost because it followed Beloved, and it is an amazing book. And the essays, of course, and I just went back and picked up Home, which I hadn't looked at in a while, just to kind of hear her voice again.
Lynell George is a freelance writer and journalist. Her essay, In Appreciation of the Late Toni Morrison, appeared earlier this week in the LA Times. Lynell, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, what led Gina Davis to go from actor to activist? That's next on The Frame Weekend. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn.
Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis star in a rare woman's road picture. Two women for a change finding themselves as they cross the country in Thelma and Louise.
When Thelma and Louise was released in 1991, you could actually hear the joy in the voices of movie critics that there was some sort of new kind of movie coming to the screen.
And this is a road movie and a buddy movie, but it is not just a tired recycling of those familiar themes. This movie is bold, fresh, and original.
Gina Davis followed Thelma and Louise with A League of Their Own, solidifying her as an actor in movies anchored by women. It didn't last. Like a lot of other women in Hollywood, Davis found jobs were few and far between, and that's the focus of the new documentary, This Changes Everything.
When Thelma and Louise came out, it was really fun to be in a movie that struck a nerve like that. And all the press was talking about, now everything's going to change. This movie was such a phenomenon that there's going to be so many more movies with women leads or female buddy pictures, road pictures, whatever. Soon enough, I realized it wasn't the truth.
There is the moral argument, like this is what the country looks like and this is how it should be presented. There's the economic argument. This is how well these things do when there are diverse casts and diverse filmmakers. But then there's the impact argument. And I want to talk about a clip in the documentary where you're talking about how images of women in TV and film really impact young women and girls.
In 2012, my archery coach noticed that when both Brave and The Hunger Games came out, suddenly, the percentage of girls taking up archery shot up 105%.
This is called, I think in the documentary, the CSI effect, and that's tied to how many women entered forensics after all of the CSI shows.
We don't have enough real-life role models. If we were seeing women be presidents and important people, and if half of our CEOs of Fortune 500 companies were women, we would see that, and then you'd say, oh, I realize I can be that, too. But we don't have enough female role models by any means, and so it's vital to see them on screen because life really does imitate art. We just did another interesting study on the Scully effect. Fox asked us to try to measure the impact that the Dana Scully character from X-Files had on women.
What I find fantastic is any notion that there are answers beyond the realm of science. The answers are there. You just have to know where to look.
It turns out 63% of women in STEM fields cite Dana Scully as the exact person that inspired them to go into those fields.
And then there's the other issue, which is the way that women and young girls are sexualized on screen. Do you think that that is just as much of a problem, or maybe even a bigger problem, than it is about the kinds of roles that women get to play?
Oh, well, yeah, I would say it's at least an equal problem, and a very important one, because we're teaching women that their value is how they look and how they are perceived. A study recently showed that girls as young as 6 now are self-sexualizing. They have learned by 6 to see themselves through the male gaze and judge themselves that way. So it's a huge problem. And our research also shows that sexualization of characters is going up, in fact, if anything, as bad as it already was. Now, female characters from 13 to 39 are equally hypersexualized. So it's getting younger and younger, too.
We're talking with Gina Davis about her documentary, This Changes Everything. So it's hard to figure out the systems in place that need to be changed, but there are systems. I think you describe it in the film as a spider web of who knows whom and how agents talk to producers who talk to studio executives. How does that cycle start to break apart?
Well, I think it's important for all of us, men and women, to realize we have unconscious bias because we were trained to have it from the beginning. So we have to realize we have it. You cannot say, I'm hiring based purely on merit because I'm that woke, because you're not. You know, there's all those studies, like Yale did a study that showed if you send out 2 identical resumes, one with the woman's name, first name, and one with the man's first name, and every other way identical, the man gets more job offers at a higher salary, and the people say, sounds like somebody I would like, and the woman not so much, and, you know, less money and less offers.
Over the last 5 years, I think in particular, there have been an amazing amount of studies, and the data year to year doesn't really change, but there is a trove of information now. And I'm wondering, how do you think that has or has not changed the nature of the conversation about diversity and representation?
When I started my research institute about 15 years ago, my whole idea was to try to impact on-screen representation through research, because when I first noticed how few female characters there were in kids' movies and TV, it was because my daughter was a toddler and I started showing her preschool shows and kids' videos and things. And I was horrified to see that there were far more male characters than female characters, because we're saying very clearly boys are more important than girls, men are more important than women. So whenever I had a meeting in the industry, you know, with a director, a studio exec, whoever, I'd say, have you ever noticed how few female characters there are in movies made for kids? And every single person said, No, that's not true anymore. That's been changed. That's been fixed. And before the data, they had no idea they were leaving out that many female characters. So we've yet to leave any meeting where somebody hasn't said, you just changed my project, or you just changed all of our projects.
There's a lot of talk about hiring women, both in front of and behind the camera. At the end of this documentary, directed by Tom Donahue, shot by a man as well. So I guess I'm going to put you on the spot and say, explain.
Yeah. Well, it was his idea to make this film, and raised all the money himself and hired himself, you know, to shoot it. And I came on board about 2 years in. He had already been shooting it for a couple of years, and then heard about my research institute and asked me to come on board. So I was thrilled to, you know, I thought it was great.
Gina, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
This Changes Everything is in theaters now. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. In 1999, filmmaker Stanley Kubrick released what would be his final film, 20 years later, we revisit Eyes Wide Shut. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited its composer, Jocelyn Pook, in London.
No one used music quite like Stanley Kubrick. He was obsessive about it, and he liked control. After Spartacus in 1960, he rarely even worked with a composer, preferring to use existing classical music instead. Jocelyn Pook certainly never expected to get a phone call from Stanley Kubrick. She never even planned on composing music for film.
You know, I enjoyed writing music, but I think I grew up with this idea that, you know, you had to be a very particular kind of virtuoso, pianist, kind of conductor, sort of very confident. I just thought people like me didn't become composers.
Pook grew up in London, and she studied music in college. She played viola with a parade of pop artists throughout the 1980s, including PJ Harvey and Susie and the Banshees.
Southern trees, they're strange fruit.
In the mid-90s, she started writing music for experimental theater and dance companies, influenced by minimalist composers like Steve Reich and Philip Glass, and using lots of vocal samples.
My Bible is this compilation of CDs called Voix du Monde, Voices of the World. It's like field recordings from 70s and 80s, even earlier, I think, from all over the world, from like pygmy African tribes to, you know, yodelers in Switzerland, you know.
This fairly obscure piece, Blow the Wind, P.A. Jesu, got Pook a big mobile phone ad, which landed her a deal with Virgin Records. In 1997, she released her first album, Deluge. An English choreographer, Yolanda Snaith, was playing that album in rehearsal. Cue Stanley Kubrick.
And that's how he heard my music. He walked in at the right time.
Kubrick hired Snaith to choreograph the notorious masked ball scene in Eyes Wide Shut. Half an hour after Kubrick heard Pook's music in that rehearsal, he gave her a ring.
I got called. I was on the other line and I had to put Stanley on hold. So go back to the other person and say, oh, I've got to go because it's Stanley Kubrick. And he patiently waited. And he said, well, I'm really interested in this piece you've written and I'd love to hear more of your music.
Eyes Wide Shut is an erotic nightmare starring Tom Cruise as Dr. William Harford, who finds out that his wife, played by his then real life wife, Nicole Kidman, fantasized about having an affair, and he wanders out into a sexual dark night of the soul. He learns about a secret orgy in a mansion in the countryside and discovers a bizarre ritual with masked men and women.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Password, sir?
Fidelia.
Thank you, sir.
Kubrick wanted to use Pook's music for the arrival at the masked ball and the following orgy. Pook had originally written the track Backwards Priest for a theater piece about homophobia in the church. She took the recording of a priest in a Romanian Orthodox church and ran it backwards.
It was like really primitive the way I was working on like reel-to-reel at that time, you know, like 8-track. I was also experimenting with, you know, reversing voice, and I literally did that by turning the tape round.
The marriage between that track and that scene was instantly iconic. However,
the orgy scene wasn't so easy. I remember at one point he said, look, sexy music, you know, and it's like, what is sexy music? You know, it's like, and I did so many sketches for that bloody orgy scene, but he ended up finding an existing piece of mine for that, which I never would have suggested in a million years.
How do you explain how you like music and why? You know, it's the one thing you really can't say.
Christiana Kubrick, the director's widow, remembers Jocelyn Pook coming over to their grand mansion in the countryside, which is where she and I chatted. In fact, I passed several of the masks from Eyes Wide Shut as I entered.
I know he liked her music. He gushed over certain bits of it and listened to it again and again and again. And he was a person who played music a lot anyway, and he particularly liked hers. Yeah, we were fans.
People always say, "Oh, what was it like working with Stanley Kubrick?" But it was just like any other director. He wasn't a control freak at all. And from my perspective, he was completely open to new ideas and, you know, exploring. And yeah, it was normal and nice.
Two words you wouldn't expect to hear about the creation of the masked ball scene in Eyes Wide Shut. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
Coming up next on The Frame Weekend, how SNL writer Julio Torres found his absurd comic voice.
There's not really a calculated process behind what I do. It's more like I'm just going about my day, sort of giggling to myself and then thinking, okay, this I think is another one for the show.
It's The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Julio Torres is a writer on Saturday Night Live. He lives in New York, so we connected with him in a studio in Manhattan. I can't see you, but I'm curious, what is the hair color du jour?
My hairstylist refers to it as sunset, a sunset color. Sort of like a wheat field at sunrise.
It's very nice. So, like, this weekend, his new comedy special debuted on HBO. And really, you could call Julio Torres a stand-up comedian, but he actually does most of his comedy sitting down. And that's because he tells jokes about objects, and he needs to hold them in his hands and display them to the audience. His special is called My Favorite Shapes, and it's not the only thing he does on HBO. He also co-created and co-stars in Los Espookies, which just got renewed for a second season. I'm wondering, at what point did you figure out that you could do an entire show about shapes and then have what I'll call the heightened sushi conveyor belt, bringing objects by with your little foot pedal to advance the tray of delights?
So I've been finding objects to be very funny from a very young age. My mom is an architect and my dad is a civil engineer. Sometimes they would make fun of poorly designed spaces or like poorly designed objects. Everything in my home was always very considered. We didn't have a lot of space, so every inch mattered deeply. So I think the combination of having an appreciation for good design while a humor about poor design was something that was always in my mind.
One of the things I really love about the objects is that in many cases, they're things that we look at and don't really understand the role that they play. You kind of imagine yourself speaking as the object that you're about to show.
Okay, well, I'm sorry if you don't like what I do, and I'm sorry if you don't like what I stand for, but I actually keep the economy going, and my job is pretty important. I'm sorry if you can handle that, but we live in a nation of laws and rules are rules. I'm sorry if you can handle that. That is that nasty little curtain that divides first class from coach. And look, I understand that it's a job and that some curtain has to do it. But to be a curtain and pick that as your curtain job is like, who hurt you? Why?
How quickly did you realize that that kind of comedy matched what you wanted to say comically?
There's not really a calculated process behind what I do. It's not like I think, okay, so I figured out the formula. I find an object, and then I come up with a little story behind it. It's more like I'm just going about my day, noticing things, and then sort of giggling to myself, and then thinking, okay, this, I think, is another one for the show. I think that the real work, writing-wise, came in curating the show, being like, okay, so I have all these objects that I'm really excited by. How do I organize them in a way that makes sense and flows and feels like the viewer leaves with a greater something, that they add up to a greater whole? And I hope they do.
We're talking with writer and comedian Julio Torres about his new special, My Favorite Shapes. I want to ask you about how you figure what the balance is in comedy between what's topical and what's not. Because you used to do a Saturday Night Live sketch called Melania Moments.
Melania Trump approached a window in Trump Tower and gazed down on Fifth Avenue. She saw a man walk just out of sight and wondered, what happens to them, to the people, once they leave Fifth Avenue?
At a certain point, you decided it was no longer funny. How do you figure out what that balance is? And does Melania Moments kind of tell you what is and is not good political comedy?
I think that those videos are the closest I've gotten to doing something that was very topical. This was back when Donald Trump was a candidate. And I think at the time, not even fully a front runner. And so the take, or my perception, and I think the general public's perception of Melania shifted from, you know, princess trapped in a castle to maybe not so trapped. As for how I strike the balance between something that's topical and something that will be evergreen or long-lasting, I think that my brain is not fully wired in that wonderful way that so many comedians have of, like, reading the news and immediately making it funny an hour later. I sort of need time, and then usually the things that I come up with are not of the day, but I think hopefully you can revisit them years later and have them still make sense.
I'm going to cite something you wrote yesterday on your Instagram feed. It was a very personal and very interesting post. And you said, I got my green card in the mail about a month ago, a little over a decade after moving to the U.S. People have said to me as sort of a compliment that I'm a good example, that it's good that I'm out there representing good, hardworking immigrants, proving we can be good, creative people, and even alternative comedians. Sure, except the bad examples, the ones actually labeled invaders, are often just people with no choice but to break laws just to survive.
I find a certain level of responsibility, and that it could be, like, good to whomever reads it to share my earnest point of view in those regards. Maybe because my comedy is not political, not in the most obvious way. I don't face things head on in my work. I'm not a Seth Meyers. I'm not a Trevor Noah. I work mostly through metaphor. So because of that, I feel like I find the need to every now and then carve out a little, like, time out. This is what I'm thinking about this. And yeah, like, something that I've been thinking a lot about is this notion that to just bring home the truth that people who come here illegally or seeking asylum don't love that they have to do that. They don't want to come here. They wish they could be thriving where they're from.
Julio Torres is a writer and comedian, co-creator of the series Los Spookies. His comedy special is called My Favorite Shapes. Julio, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. 50 years ago, nearly 500,000 young people converged on a New York farm to attend Woodstock. But until now, the only people who heard all the music performed at the legendary festival were the people who were there. Producer Andy Zaks has spent the last 14 years collecting and restoring all 3 days of audio from Woodstock, every song, every performer, every sound. And he's now released a 38-CD set, Woodstock, Back to the Garden, the definitive 50th anniversary archive.
One day, this massive quantity of tape magically appeared on one of the shelves, and as I looked at it, I realized, like, oh, this is Woodstock. This is all of Woodstock. Maybe took me about 15 seconds of staring at this stuff before I realized, okay, there's clearly just a vast trove of material that no one's ever heard before, so we should hear it. I really wanted this to be an accurate representation of Woodstock. all of the previous audio documentation of Woodstock had been tweaked, sweetened, faked, augmented.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of the most beautiful men in the whole world. Let's welcome Mr. Richie Havens.
Five, Dino's guitar.
The Woodstock tapes are all about hiss and hum, and it is a part of the sound of it. And if you try to remove that stuff, as people have done in the past, all you wind up doing is damaging the music. The music will sound terrible if you treat it as a defect or a mistake.
Groovy.
You can't.
Groovy. Okay. Wow.
Helicopter noise, of course, one of the great trademarks of Woodstock, those buzzing helicopters. So you are getting the full spectrum of Woodstockiness on that, just in that brief clip that we heard. We did an awful lot of audio restoration on the Woodstock tapes. So, I mean, there's two different types of tape. You've got multi-track recording, which is where most of the sound comes from. And then there were some mono recordings that were just the audio that went straight through the soundboard and was captured on a mono tape recorder that somebody at the sound desk was running. What you're going to hear is the very beginning of Janis Joplin's set at Woodstock, and she's singing a song called Raise Your Hand. This is the multi-track version of that performance. It is missing the vocal for about the first minute or thereabouts. It's missing the vocal because, and this was a pretty common thing during first songs at Woodstock, somebody forgot to put the vocal mic up. So the vocal is missing. In the second clip, you'll hear the mono soundboard feed of that performance, which does contain Janis's vocal, and you'll hear it loud and clear.
It fills in the thing that you need. Oh, not you never, ever, ever hide.
Until recently, trying to sync up the mono soundboard tapes with the multi-track tapes was technically agony because the variation in tape speeds between those machines was just enough to make it nearly impossible for longer than 4 or 5 seconds before the tapes would go out of sync again, and you couldn't really do it. Fortunately, now that we live in the future, we can now mix Janis's vocal from the mono soundboard back into the multi-track version of the song, so we finally have a complete, real mix of that song for the very first time ever. There were only 400, 450,000 people who were actually there on Max Yasger's farm, but millions and millions of people saw Michael Wadley's documentary, which came out less than a year later. And that film, which is a great razzle-dazzle treatment of Woodstock, that film really wrote the history of Woodstock in the popular imagination. There are things he chose not to use for whatever reasons, time, space, business reasons, that were just as great from a musical perspective as anything that's in the movie, but because they weren't in the movie, they were written out of history. And it was thrilling to kind of experience this fuller, more complete, more fascinating version of Woodstock that had innumerable highlights that don't exist on the movie soundtrack and don't exist in the film.
And when it's over...
Burt Sommer, to me, is the great lost performer of Woodstock. He was a New York-based singer-songwriter, and he was in the original New York production of Hair. That's actually his hair that you will see on the poster for the original New York production of Hair. I believe that was his first real live performance, Woodstock, which is an unbelievable thing to think about. He went on third, just as the sun was going down on the first night, and he nails the crowd right from the get-go. He has this extraordinary vocal range, and he's dramatic, and there's just something kind of beautiful about his songwriting.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop.
the way it may have seemed at the time, Woodstock might have felt like this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And I don't think that was true. Maybe Woodstock was more like a transition point. I think that's probably fair to say. And it's kind of a moment where what had been thought of as the counterculture kind of became the culture.
Andy Zax's 38-CD set, Woodstock, Back to the Garden, the definitive 50th anniversary archive, will cost you about 3 days of your life and about $800. It's been a tough week here in the United States, so we're going to hear from members of the Frame team on how they find joy, calm, and connection in these troubling times. And first up is me. Our book group has been together for more than 30 years through marriages, divorces, births, deaths, and rarely have we all loved a book as much as we just did The Overstory. It's a novel by Richard Powers, and you can say it's about trees, but it won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, not just for what it says about the natural world, but about how disparate people can be drawn together by caring about the natural world. There's some heartbreaking parts in The Overstory, but I think it's ultimately really hopeful about what can happen when someone decides to take a stand and do something.
This is Darby Maloney, editor of The Frame, and my feel-good recommendation is to put on an album that you haven't heard in a long time. You might surprise yourself and find that you know every lyric of every song. That happened to me this week with Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville.
And when I asked for a separate room...
Can I go?
Jonathan?
Hey, my name's Jonathan. I'm one of the producers on The Frame. I'm going to recommend a new album by a funk guitarist. His name is Corey Wong. He plays rhythm guitar for the band Wolfpack, where he's known as the man with helicopter hands. And he has a new album called Motivational Music for the Syncopated Soul.
Hey, I'm Julia. I'm a producer, and I say things sometimes for the radio waves. Sometimes when I'm looking for something to watch, I'm looking for a cathartic experience. So I, these days, sometimes need to cry a little bit. So I go for something a little darker, and I watch a favorite of mine, which is Kwadwo's Children of Men.
Oh, call my baby Dylan. It's a girl's name, too.
I watch that, and I cry my eyes out and recalibrate and think about what's important to me. So there's a little bit of sadness for you. The end.
Hey, I'm Robert Garova. I'm one of the producers on The Frame. When I'm particularly stressed or the news of the day has me particularly down, sometimes I like to put on pretty much anything by a Japanese musician named Chihei Takayama. It's super minimal, very soundscapey type of stuff, but if you really just need to put your brain to rest and sort of drown out whatever else is going on outside, I highly recommend it. And he's got a new album out just this year.
Are we good with levels? All right. Hi, my name is Andrea Gutierrez. I am the news clerk for The Frame, and what's been giving me life this week is Lizzo's Tiny Desk Concert.
I feel so juicy, you know what I'm saying? I want to thank God for making me so juicy.
The track I'm picking for this is actually Juice, and she talks about being so juicy, and I think that's like a really great description of what she looks like at the Tiny Desk. She looks really juicy.
You can sing along, don't be shy. I know it's all right, microphone.
That's it. This is Lizzo's Tiny Desk Concert.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, don't say it because I know I'm cute. Glue it down to my drawers, LV all on my shoe.
My name's Paul Ratliff. I'm the production intern here at The Frame. When my life gets overwhelming, my go-to musician is a guy named Carl Anthony. Not very many people know about him. He's from San Diego. And his latest record is called Hold the Sky. And it is like, especially the title track, The title track is like the most regulating music I've ever heard.
When the ground is shaking under me, hold the sky.
Shut up already, damn!
This is Oscar Garza, senior producer of The Frame, and when I'm in a funk, I simply turn up the funk. I try not to think about the fact that Prince is no longer with us and just revel in songs like this.
Shake your body till your neighbors stare at you. House square. Everybody, everybody jump on it down. House square.
You just heard from the team that produces The Frame. I also want to give a shout out to our engineer, Valentino Rivera, and our opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We hope you have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back with a daily version of The Frame on Monday.
Damn, you got to get off. You know what?